future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Hey, welcome everybody. It is Monday, June 28, 2021. Welcome to Raging Chickens Out the Coop Live. Well, it's actually a bit of a misnomer. You see, we're actually pre-recording this on the 21st, so it seems a little strange to me to be saying it's the 28th, and I just thought I'd share that little bit of kind of weirdness with all of you. Yes, I know you wanted to know, right? Yes, 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 indeed. But we want to make sure that you had, I'm going to be away next week, so we want to make sure that you had a brand new show that was coming out on the 28th. On Out to Coop Live, we talked to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards, from across the country. And on Friday, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And you can check out our new show. Yes, we got a new show called The Wednesday Show with Cyril Michalako. Cyril is a progressive columnist from the Bucks County Courier-Times and the Intelligencer. And he joins me to drill down into Bucks County, PA, and international politics. Yep, local, global, all in one. How about that? And you can join me, and you can get all these shows, right, by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, on Spotify, on Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show live on the Podbean app, well, awesome. Subscribe. Get on over and subscribe. You can help out the show by heading on over to our YouTube channel, too, if you're not there already, and smash that subscribe button, like the stream for the show, and hit that notification bell so you know every time that we go live. For more PA-based progressive talk, tune in to the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern, and on his YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, you know, wherever streaming happens, Rick's show is there. You can also subscribe to his daily podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You go to ricksmithshow.com for all the latest across all his platforms. And you absolutely must check out the recently launched Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. The amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Well, make sure to follow them on Twitter at The Night Caucus. That's at The Night Caucus. And subscribe to their podcast on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And attention to gamers, The Game Inn, that's with two N's. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based, black family-owned gaming store. And I'll tell you, in a days in which the gaming world is marked by white nationalist and kind of right-wing crazies, this is where you want to go to get your games, right? They're awesome. They're friends of the show. They're the family of my son's best friend, right? So get on over there and check them out. It's where you want to give your business. They've got everything, the retro N64s, latest consoles, video games for all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops. And kids, they got an A in their last report card to end this crazy year? Well, they get a discount. So check them out. You can check them out on their Facebook page. Follow them on Twitter at The Game Inn. That's with two N's. And if you got a question for them, look for something specific, just shoot them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com. And a special shout out goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at songadayman, again with two N's, at songadayman on Twitter. Well, on tonight's show, I welcome Dana Morrison and Eleni Shermer to the show to talk about that other debt crisis in American colleges and universities. Well, you've probably heard about the crisis in student debt that is crushing a whole generation of graduates from American colleges and universities. However, the crushing debt held by colleges and universities threatened to crush American higher education as a whole, especially American public higher education, and that's happening across the country. Yes, as we'll get into, the debt crisis stems from state legislatures walking away from funding state universities on the one hand, and university presidents going on spending sprees to erect shiny luxury dorms and state-of-the-art gyms and fancy amenities in a full-on neoliberal approach to attracting students. Yes, you could call it the sham of disaster capitalism, if you will. Well, my guest here, Dr. Dana Morrison, is an assistant professor at Westchester University's Department of Educational Foundations and Policy Studies. She's an active member of ABSCUF, as you all know. That is the faculty union for the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education Faculty, and the public higher education workers are the few network, which is awesome because we need, somebody's organizing. That's awesome. And Eleni Shermer is a faculty associate at University of Wisconsin-Madison in educational policy studies, where she researches and teaches about labor movements, social movements, and the political economy of education. She is writing a political biography of Wisconsin's largest teachers union and its unsteady path towards social justice unionism. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The Nation, Boston Review, and elsewhere. Dana, Eleni, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, you got it.
It's awesome to be here. This is cool. Thanks.
Well, yeah, I'm thrilled to have you. I mean, like, and you know, this is, and it seems like this is going to be the summer where a lot of, you know, the multiple overlapping crises in higher education are really going to come to a head. And I mean, you all have been, active in so many different ways. And of late, you know, I've been following the work that, you know, we've seen this appear in The Nation. I saw Eleni, I first came across some of your stuff when you were helped leading a workshop with AAUP. Dana, of course, she's been on the show before. We've been talking about the crisis in higher ed, what's happening here in Pashi. But the focus on, say, the university's debt is a debt that we often don't hear about. I mean, obviously student debt has been in the news, right? Approaching $2 trillion, right? Nationwide. But the university's debt that you are putting front and center seems to be absolutely critical for everyone to understand. So why don't I kind of like hand it over to you a little bit, talk a little bit about like how you're framing this issue, what's happening with university students' debt and how we're getting here.
Sure. So, you know, debt to a degree has a bit always been how universities have run on. And a lot of institutions, big institutions, finance themselves through debt. And there's a, you know, a long history of that. But in the last 30 or 40 years, as state and federal budgets have shrunk or been slashed is probably the better word. Mm-hmm. And there's less and less funding that comes to especially public universities. Universities have to come up with some way to cover those costs, and debt becomes a very important financing tool that they use to cover their operating costs in the wake of declined state and federal monies. This is kind of part of a broader transition that the economic sociologist Wolfgang Strieck talks about as the transition from the tax state to the debt state, where sort of welfare services, you know, welfare like all kinds of public goods and institutions that at one point in time were more funded through tax revenues as the state has sort of rolled back its tax commitments and given more corporations and wealthy people are paying less and less money. There's debt becomes the way to keep the doors open on our campuses.
So, well, what's interesting to me too about that is the way that you just kind of lay that out a little bit is that, you know, it's a different kind of squeeze than we've seen in other parts of the economy where we see a straight on privatization of public goods. Right, where there's a takeover, like a corporate takeover and a replacement of the public by the private. And here with this debt crisis, it's like you bring in the banking sector to do the squeeze in some ways. Right.
So
it's one of these things where it's harder to see. You don't have this faceless corporation, you know, or this kind of, you know, coming in to kind of take over something or privatize it where you have these public hearings. But you have this slow drip and accumulation of debt that happens very much outside of public scrutiny.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's one of the projects that Dana and I have really been involved with is this idea that you can't organize around something you can't see. You can't change. You don't understand how you're being crushed if you can't actually see the weight that's on you. So we've been part of a big national effort over the last year to reveal institutional debt, to try to make visible this, what we call the invisible architecture of our universities, and to help people get more of an understanding around how this financialization of our universities, how debt is part of the financializations of our universities. And it's, you know, it's a really powerful issue because it's debt is a, in some ways, university debt is very intimately connected to student debt. It's very intimately connected to declining workers' pay to job layoffs, to furloughs, to all of the things that have been sort of heightened in the last year. University debt is really kind of at the core of that. So it's an we think it's a really important issue, not just because it's creating more and more inequality, but also because it is really ripe for organizing around because of all so many people that are all sort of affected by its kind of fall prey to its wake.
Absolutely. And Dana, you know, I mean, we've been seeing this firsthand right here in Pennsylvania. That's absolutely for sure. And what's been striking too is as these issues have become more to the fore, as the work that, say, you and Eleni and others are doing, you know, whether we're talking about the debt collective, or we're talking about various kind of faculty unions, or, you know, even like, you know, watchdogs, public watchdogs, start to expose this. What's been interesting is that, you know, the debt that universities have been holding and accumulating, nobody seems to have wanted to talk about that, right? I mean, legislators, university presidents, they've avoided that issue almost entirely. So, you know, I mean, not to kind of like dive like completely into Pennsylvania, but I know that this has been a kind of a motivating factor in terms of the quote unquote crisis that we're having here in Pennsylvania as well.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that, you know, we found recently that was perhaps the most like shocking, but also the most expected thing you could possibly imagine is, you know, public leaders who are making decisions about the Pennsylvania state system, identifying, you know, like very concretely in numerical numbers, the amount of money that a lot of these schools that are being proposed to be consolidated, that amount of money that they are essentially, you know, in need of on a yearly basis is the exact equivalent to the amount of debt service they pay yearly. So that is principal payments and interest payments, you know, upwards of tens of millions of dollars. I think the number that State Senator quota was $70 million in annual debt service between those schools. And so what we see is the option on the table that we're being presented with is, you know, we have to consolidate. We have to have 1,500 job losses. We have to have, you know, economic devastation for rural communities. We have to force students to accept less for the exact same costs as they were paying, you know, the year before, because we can't not pay that debt service. We have to continue to pay Wall Street. So I think what we're trying to do, you know, over the past year is to reveal that that is a choice that is being made by public officials to take, you know, an institution who, you know, Act 2088 in Pennsylvania says the purpose of this institution is to provide quality education, quality higher education at the lowest possible cost to students. And yet what we see its mission as being is actually, you know, primarily making sure those Wall Street banks get their cut at the end of the year by way of tens of millions of dollars.
Well, what's interesting about that is that seems to me to be the kind of story, right, that would lead to absolute outrage among members of the public. Right. Especially as we've seen the graphs. This is true in Pennsylvania. This is also true like nationwide, where you have the rising amount of costs that are being borne by students and their families and the decrease of investment in kind of, say, public dollars and public higher education. And the story, at least that, you know, I've been told, the public has been told, I hear our university presidents tell over and over again, you know, I see stories in Inside Higher Ed and the Chronicle, all with the same narrative about there's rising public costs and there's public dollars that are kind of going away. And nobody mentions the debt stuff. So, I mean, I love this idea about having to kind of expose the invisible architecture, right? So that we, you know, people can actually see what we're fighting, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. In a lot of cases, it's celebrated. You know, I teach at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the university system is, the UW system is one of the few systems in the country that doesn't have an independent borrowing authority. And so every time that the university wants to get money, they have to get legislative approval. And it's been a really big sort of point of tension. And we have, you know, for the first time in a while where Wisconsin has a Democratic, for the first time in like 35 years, Wisconsin has a Democratic governor right now. And one of the things that the governor is doing is trying to get to grant the university system borrowing authority. And this is seeing people, you know, progressive folks across the state, I think are generally, certain university administrators are like, just drooling with like this possibility being dangled for them. They cannot wait to have borrowing authority because it will keep them from having to go to the legislature every time they want to build a new dorm or whatever it is, you know? But the issue is, I think a lot of folks that I've been talking to in Wisconsin don't understand why that the dangers that that presents, that getting more money when it comes through privately financed loans doesn't actually give us the kinds of freedoms that I think people imagine it gives. And I think, you know, one of the things that Dana and I have been like thinking through and talking about a lot is I personally am not 100% anti-debt. I think debt can be, it's a financial tool, but it's when there's just no reason that this isn't being financed publicly through federal financial facilities, right? That wouldn't put us, that when the money comes from private banks, when the money comes from Wall Street, they get first in line to get paid before students, you know, as students are literally mortgaging their futures to get a bachelor's degree, and workers have, you know, haven't had raises in decades. Before, you know, a campus pays its employees, before it sets its tuition, it's paying back money to private banks. And if the situation, you know, if sure we can borrow money from people, but they get paid after, you know, the other commitments, the instructional commitments of a university have been maintained, that would be a really, really different kind of debt. And those are some of the things that we're, you know, we hope in our organizing is to sort of politicize this issue. So it's not just the kind of, a lot of times people think it just kind of stays in this kind of like technocratic mumbo jumbo. Like, I don't really understand it. It's the reign of the financial experts, but it sounds like a good thing because we need, our campuses need more money, so we better get it this way, instead of having kind of a clear political analysis around what that actually entails and who's gets served by money coming in, by the money coming into our campuses in that way.
Yeah, I could totally see where, you know, it would seem like university presidents or university, even like board of trustees, right? Who I'm generally not kind of trying to empathize with, right? as a whole, but I could understand why those board of trustees who've been frustrated by conservative and increasingly right-wing state legislators would say like, okay, we get out, right? We found an exit door to get out from under their thumb. So we're going to do this. But I mean, absolutely. Then you're like saying, welcome to like the biggest banks, like, you know, in the world that crashed our economy not too long ago, right? And who are holding more and more control over not just university debt, but American society as a whole. Right.
That's, I mean, right.
And so that's what baffles me. And what seems to be, I'm glad you made this point about the shift to politically, getting it out of the kind of technocratic balance sheet, understanding financialization, all that stuff, because it seems to me that there's an emerging at the federal level, there's an emerging kind of, say, questions and increasingly pressure being put back on how the federal government can spend. Right. So we've seen calls for the elimination of all student debt. Right. And with the rise of people finally understanding a little bit more about, say, modern monetary theory, and so about why the federal government is not the same as a family's kitchen table. Right. The federal government, at least in the United States. Right. We have our own currency as a country. Right. So we cannot go bankrupt, no matter what they say. And then there's questions about then what are priorities and how do we invest that money? So it seems to me is almost like a merging of one, thinking about big programs that we need, because, I mean, this is not the only crisis certainly on the table. We have kind of like histories of white supremacy that are kind of finally being kind of discussed. We're talking about the climate crisis, right? But the crisis in higher education is absolutely one that is solvable, right, in a fairly straightforward way that doesn't have to go through Wall Street. Does that make sense, Dana?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just had a really, really simple exchange with someone on social media, you know, where I said, you know, this is a problem, we can't, you know, vote for this consolidation. And they just said, well, what is the other option to, you know, keep these schools afloat? And it's like, we fund them. Like, it's so simple that, you know, like I don't even think it's like fancy enough to be a campaign slogan, you know, for a politician somewhere, because it's so straightforward that we've clearly, you know, had a generations long divestment from public goods, particularly public higher education, you know, where in our lifetimes, we know people who are alive today who had to pay nothing to go to public institutions right. for higher education. And then we know an entire generation who is literally drowning in debt. And now we have examples, I think, particularly, you know, post-COVID, of institutions that are literally being demolished, either, you know, gutted from the inside, which is what's happening in Pennsylvania, but in other states, they've, you know, continued to maintain, you know, systems of austerity. They were proposing to cut, you know, schools in Vermont, you know, eliminate schools in Vermont, and they've had, you know, 2,800, you know, adjunct and staff cuts over at the CUNY system, right? Like, it's an ongoing onslaught of cutting the cost. But at the end of the day, everyone thinks, oh, okay, cutting costs, you know, the average person hears that and says, well, I cut costs when I need to, right?
Right.
But we're literally the ones that are doing the thing that the institution was designed to do, right? Without us there to educate, to help students enroll in courses and, you know, get financial aid and all that kind of stuff, the institution doesn't exist, right? So there's only so much you can cut out of this. And then we get to a place where the solutions become ever more clear and obvious to those who've been paying attention, you know, to a history that is not so far in our past.
That's right.
We just need to fund it. And there are plenty of options for that, right? Like, you know, Eleni was mentioning having federal lending, you know, as opposed to private lending, restructuring the debt covenant so that, you know, faculty and staff jobs and other programs are not on the table for cuts, you know, in place of paying for the Wall Street debt service. So I think there's plenty of possibilities out there. We just need to make sure that everyone knows what they are, and then we need to fight like hell for them.
And you know, it, like, one of the things that federally funding universities, even if it's a federally financed debt, if that's how the money's coming, one of the things that does that would be a huge shift is it kind of pushes the credit rating agencies out of the game, because right now the credit rating agencies have really just undue influence and governance power, frankly, over our campuses, because in an era of declined revenue, universities need credit to be able to run, and they can access credit. They're sort of disciplined by the credit rating agencies to perform according to how the credit rating agencies' priorities, which are not instructional priorities. The credit rating agency doesn't care, how many students can put into historical perspective this current moment, or, you know, all of the, how they don't care about the instructional priorities. They want to know, is this institution going to default on its loans?
Exactly.
And so things that actually in some ways enhance that, you know, I'm of the school of thought that they actually enhance the instructional priorities of the university. Things like strong working protections for adjuncts, for faculty, for staff, things like tuition that can't just get rammed up because a chancellor has decided that they need to just like bump up the tuition by 150%. These are things that I think are really important for the educational quality of an institution, and their liabilities from the point of view of a credit rating agency. So they will, it's in an instant, a university may not want, you know, the administration of a university may feel disinclined. They may not want to, you know, behave in certain ways, but as long as credit rating agencies are setting these terms, they have their hands tied a bit and have to follow suit. So I think getting those credit rating agencies out of the game and getting a federal lending program that would make it so that institutions have access to, you know, 0% interest loans, would be a real, like, a huge shift, and not just for the financial reasons, but also for the power relations that debt builds into our universities.
That is such an awesome point. And I remember that it also, by getting the credit rating agencies out of the picture too, as well, it also disincentivizes kind of all sorts of accounting schemes that have kind of occurred on campuses across the country. Like I remember, you know, God, this is back in, probably like 2013, 2014, when I was digging in through Raging Chicken, we were doing a lot of kind of investigative work. And we basically found that, you know, what universities essentially were doing in the state system of higher education is what they were doing, the Pennsylvania state system of higher education, is that they were basically producing two sets of books, right? I mean, they took, you know, they basically had the budget that they would show faculty and staff and legislators. And then they had a different set of books that they would show to the credit rating agencies, right? And basically the sleight of hand was that, okay, look, we need to show the credit rating agencies that we have good credit, so they'll continue to lend us money for our luxury dorms and all this other stuff, but we can't extract that money, right, in order to put to those things, unless we tell a different version to kind of faculty and legislators. As a matter of fact, at Westchester University, where Dane is at, we had a whistleblower, right? Colleen Bradley was assistant vice president of administrative affairs, and she basically kind of blew the whistle on this stuff. And, you know, and as much as that specific instance shows you this kind of corruption and deception and all that stuff, the incentives are, again, coming out of this, you know, the defunding of public higher education, right? And this, what I also see is this kind of misguided sense of like, well, how do we get back on track? Well, we're just going to kind of show like students that we've got like Olympic sized swimming pools and climbing walls and kind of workout sessions. So we're going to take on more debt in the hopes that this is going to go. And we just feeds the cycle, right? And
exactly.
And I remember seeing this happening like university by university across the country, right? Right around that same time. And now it seems like we're at the point where, look, it's like it's a reckoning, right? That it's either now or never that we address this as a political movement. So if we're sitting here right now, if we're looking at like both at the federal level, there's some possibilities here. Let's talk a little bit about some of the work that you all are doing on organizing, right? And some of the things that are kind of happening. Now, I know that there was it was April 15th, I believe, right? Was kind of like the coming out day, as it were, of this campaign. Walk us through a little bit about what that was about and where organizing stands right now. I don't know who would like to take that one up.
So what we had done over those couple of months leading up to the debt reveal day on April 15th was essentially build a lot of resources for faculty members, staff members, even students to sort of start the investigation process of revealing the invisible structure of this debt, right? So we created a university debt toolkit, which helped folks kind of take on this step-by-step identification of how much money does your university, or we did one for the state system, how much does the state system owe, and then of course how much they pay yearly in debt service, and then put those into real terms. So part of the process was to say, okay, the state system has $122 million it pays every single year in debt service alone. What would that mean? Like, what can we do with that instead of send it to the banks? You know what I mean? So, and what we found was just, incredible. We were at one time retrenching 113 faculty members, laying off staff members, freezing adjuncts, cutting programs at some of our, major institutions in the state of Pennsylvania. And it would cover all of those things, right? Like, it covers every single one of those things if that didn't exist. And I think part of the organizing process we went through was, helping folks understand what that was and what it meant for them. And then, of course, like how they can use that to politicize the issue of university financing with people on their campus, with students, staff members, faculty, et cetera. So we were bringing people together, and we're still working on like the next steps of making maybe a more concerted effort in different areas of the country, and then hopefully coming up with some demands, some of which Eleni already alluded to.
Yeah, I think Dana said, you know, and one of the things too that is like been part of this is that we're very adamant about is that very few of us who are involved in this campaign are economists, are exactly. financial advisors, are CPAs. It's really part of the work that we're trying to do to organize around is, you know, as we discussed before, is to take it out of the realm of the technocratic elite, the financial, is it, you know, the financialese. You can't talk about this problem. You can't have a problem with this problem if you are not a financial expert, is sort of how a lot of us have come to think about this. And what we're trying to do is really kind of drill it down to sort of its most basic and fundamental dimensions. And part of it is actually, you know, you find your university's financial statement for the year, which is not difficult to do. They all have to submit one. And you do a control F debt service when you open up that PDF document. And it actually, you can begin to see a story by just doing something as simple as that and helping people kind of see, gain the confidence to understand that that this is actually our problem. It's not just the financial experts' situation.
And that seems to be such a powerful move to be able to make, be able to say, one, to identify even like what the actual numbers are, right? Say, here we are. And to know that, look, you don't have to like get over the hump of becoming a financial expert before you actually engage in this. And I think that, I mean, I love that toolkit. That toolkit, I you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, you don't know exactly that you need it until you see it all, right? I mean, I remember wading through financial like reports to try to understand what was going on, and it was like a freaking maze. And what the toolkit does, and what I've seen, I mean, I've seen, you know, followed some of the presentations that you all have been doing, and some of the kind of teach-ins that you've been doing in lots of different capacities, is basically saying, like, look, first of all, you got to understand that the debt is not kind of like a force of nature. It's a result of choices, right? Number two, it's not so mysterious that you can't find, right? That it's actually, there's a pretty straightforward line. And number three, if a choice has got us into this, choices can get us out. And then so basically showing us what are the political alternatives here, right?
Totally.
So what kind of organizing else have you seen kind of burgeoning kind of up around this stuff? I mean, you know, it always seems to be is like, you know, it's, the debt question doesn't seem to be an exclusively kind of set off from every other issue that's going on in higher education in terms of that struggle. So it seems to me a lot of the work that you all are doing is going to feed directly into the kind of defenses for, say, especially public higher education right now. Are you finding that kind of move? I'm sorry. My bad. I should have said
that. No. I think, you know, I think some of that, I think absolutely, I think it is starting to happen, and people are, you know, seeing how debt is connected to workers' pay cuts, to furloughs, to retrenchment, to layoffs, and also student tuition. I think that's absolutely starting to happen. And I think, you know, one of the things that was really startling in the past 6 months and really didn't get a lot of attention was that at the end, one of the last things that Trump did in 2020 was he signed a bill that forgave all institutional debt at HBCUs. So this is like a really powerful example. Donald Trump made the move to say, yeah, you know what? Institutional debt, we're wiping it off. And one of the reasons it was these HBCUs had gotten, thanks to some, you know, progressive organizing and some visionary leadership, had gotten federal financing in maybe 5 or 10 years before, so that the federal government had been the holders of this debt. So they were in the position to be able to forgive it. Forgiven is our Dana and I's comrade and colleague Jason always reminds us not to talk about forgiveness with debt. It's, they were able to abolish that debt because they owned it. And I think that's like a really great, you know, to my knowledge, I don't know if that was a product of organizing, if folks on those campuses had been organizing for it, but I think it's a really good reminder that this was a horizon that actually Donald Trump walked us towards. And if he was taking us there, I should hope we could ask at least as much from President Biden and our other officials, just to kind of, I think people, it can be really easy. One of the organizing challenges around this is it's a big problem, and it's a bit challenging for any one institution. You know, workers can win raises workplace by workplace, but it's unlikely that a university will fight off debt. You know, one university can't decide they're not going to pay back their creditors. It needs to be a larger scale. So it can feel a bit totalizing and overwhelming to organize around because the scale is so big. And I think having these kind of reminders that the horizon may be closer than we think is an important part of the work, that the organizing work that's ahead of us.
Absolutely. Dana? Yeah.
Yeah. Just add that, you know, one thing that's happening in Pennsylvania around that. So obviously, getting rid of debt for the HBCUs was a possibility. And one thing that's happening in PA is there's all of this stimulus money that's sitting there currently, billions of dollars, as well as additional revenue from state taxes that they didn't anticipate having. And there's sort of discussions happening in Harrisburg right now, like, what do we do with this, you know, billions and billions of dollars? Well, the state system of Pennsylvania is, you know, proposing to consolidate 6 of our 14 historic institutions. We have $1.2 billion in system-wide debt. If we could get rid of that with some of this stimulus money, it wouldn't even be, you know, so I heard one of the things the Republicans are always hesitant to is, oh, we don't want to use federal money for things that are recurring costs. Well, this wouldn't be a recurring cost, right? It would be a one-time get rid of those payments for the foreseeable future, right? Until, you know, another administrator decides to build an unnecessary dorm or something like that, right? which maybe we could stop. But in this situation, I imagine that other states are having similar conversations, right? Like, what do we do with this money? It's happening in Pennsylvania right now. And the choice is very clear, right? Like, are we going to have these billions of dollars that essentially just, you know, continue to allow whatever folks to have tax cuts and not actually support state systems? Or do we get rid of something that's literally dragging a lot of our institutions under? So there's a lot of possibilities out there. Additionally, you know, I've heard folks toy around with the idea of the state taking on the system's debt. You know, obviously the schools would still operate the buildings and things like that, but that the debts would be owned by the state as opposed to the institutions, which is a constant drain on their budget. So I think there are just tons of quick possibilities in the moment of crises that are being created, and then also a lot of the long term, you know, ideas that Eleni was highlighting, that we can also work towards to make sure that this isn't a continual issue, and that we're actually addressing the root of the problem.
So let me ask you this before I ask you where you think where people can go to kind of say connect up to the work that you're all doing and so on. I mean, we've obviously come out of one hell of a year with the pandemic. And, you know, I've had Brian Bailey and some other folks kind of come on the show to talk a little bit about the way that the COVID pandemic has been utilized to paper over a whole bunch of other crises, or being used as an excuse by which to accomplish other ends. So I'm curious, when it comes to this, I mean, it seems to me that we need a political movement more than ever right now around these issues, precisely because it seems to be an easy sidestep on the part of university administrations or state legislators simply to say, you know, because COVID, right? Why do we have to do all this stuff? Because COVID. Why can't we have nice things? Because COVID. As opposed to it being, so again, not a force of nature, but a series of choices. So I'm curious, in talking to folks about this debt stuff and looking at what's happening, you know, obviously here in Pennsylvania, we're, you know, yet another crisis point. where in, you know, in a matter of weeks, there's a potential vote that's going to be taken to kind of consolidate universities that could potentially decimate access for higher education for a whole bunch of folks, but in particular in rural PA. These things are happening. And I see this, you know, again and again in Inside Higher Ed and Chronicle of Higher Education, there's stories day by day where, you know, the excuse of everything is, you know, well, because COVID. I'm curious what kind of how you see organizing at this moment, obviously specifically around the debt issue, but kind of more broad, because I know that you're both of you are involved in organizing in higher ed and beyond just the stuff on debt. So what's your sense of things right now, especially as we're trying to organize all this stuff over the summer?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you caught me on a depressing Monday. I don't know. Right? Like, it depends on the day and the moment when I'm asked this question about how I feel about it. Uh-huh. I think there's a lot of possibilities in this moment. I think, obviously, like, my head is very much in Pennsylvania and the Pennsylvania state system. But I do see ways in which this current moment has connected people. Obviously we had the very real, like, what you do impacts me in terms of, like, my health and safety reckoning that happened over the past year. But I also think, you know, there's an openness to changing what is in this moment. And so I hope that, you know, what we can do a little bit of is identify folks who are just tired of the crap, you know, like, tired, yes, of this moment and the same thing, which is, you know, being told that things can be better and then nothing happens. And, you know, I think hopefully starting small and local is something that everybody can do, because as I said, like, this is a conversation that's happening in Pennsylvania, but it's happening in different ways everywhere. And so hopefully by identifying the ways that it's happening locally everywhere, we can start to connect to one another on a broader scale. So one of the things we're hoping to do is, you know, start to look at different places, different locations where those things might be able to begin, and then, you know, ideally bring larger change once folks start to realize the connections between, you know, say, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, not identical, but the broader structures of how things are operating and why we're here in the position we are, is very connected.
100%. And I think that, you know, this is also an opportunity. I know that, you always hear in higher education, and you do any of our higher education organizing, about how difficult it is to organize over the summer. But I think if we just kind of flip around our thoughts about organizing in higher ed a little bit here and say, yes, it's true that you're not going to be having, say, you know, demonstrations outside the university necessarily as we have organizing, but this is really the opportunity to dig in and do the research and strategize and connect with folks. And I love what you said there about, you know, this is an opportunity to link up with people that are experiencing, you know, the debt crisis at their kind of local level. And yes, it might not be exactly the same, but it's certainly the place that we can talk about strategies and tactics about how to kind of tackle this stuff as we kind of move forward. And I always like, you know, look at, like, in any organizing, is that you've got your pressure points. In Pennsylvania, you've got a state budget. Right. And they're going to have to vote on that budget. And that becomes one of these pressure points. We have the start up to the fall semester, right, which is always yet another pressure point. And so, it's, you know, this seems to me like be a perfect time to kind of dig into some of these, you know, some of the toolkits that's being offered that, you know, that you all are kind of working on, and some of the organizing and, you know, connecting up with people kind of around there. So let me ask you this, too, as well. It's a bit, on the side of it, you know, I know the public higher education workers, you've been doing kind of like a ton of stuff with them too as well. And they've been organizing a lot kind of around the country too, as well, looking forward. What are some of the issues that you've got kind of on the front that you're working with there?
I think one of the good things about FHEW, the Public Higher Education Workers Network, is that it's really a space where whatever the local issue is, that there's a place to bring that local issue and have a conversation about how to build power around addressing it. So, you know, there's the New Jersey state system is having a lot of turmoil with layoffs and things like that currently. You know, we spent a good amount of time talking about that last week. You know, and not only just like standing in solidarity with folks who have, you know, lost their positions, but also, you know, having conversations about like, well, what can we do when this is the particular situation that we're in? So I think, you know, the general issues that everyone are facing are, you know, similar, although they tend to look, you know, unique for their particular locations. And what the Few Network does is really provide a space for us to have like strategizing conversations about like our individual context and what we can do about that. Like where, you know, kind of just do what Jane McAlevey called a power structure analysis, right? Where we're looking at all of the barriers and all of the bureaucracies that stand in our way. But then of course also where is the power of the people, the workers, you know, the students, the student workers, and how can we, you know, recognize those power opportunities and build them towards, you know, addressing whatever we might be facing.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, if you got other folks that are kind of looking to find ways of getting involved or finding out more information about what is happening on the resources that you all have been putting together and some of the workshops that you've been doing, where can folks go for more information?
So I would say probably the quickest thing is our website. It's kind of a long link, so I can share it, I guess, and you can post it in the description.
Indeed.
It's housed at Salem State. And we also have, you know, stuff from past webinars, past events, the toolkit, et cetera. And then, of course, you can also follow the Public Higher Education Workers Network or FHEW. On Facebook and Twitter. We meet in the summer, we meet every Wednesday at 3. So if you're a person who like feels as if you wish your university, you know, your colleagues, your union, whoever, like we're doing more to actually fight against the austerity that we're all facing, come chat with FHEW, share what's going on in your context and get some feedback on where you might be able to, operate.
Fantastic. And Eleni, you have other kind of suggestions where people could go to kind of get connected?
I think FHEW is a great one. I'm part of the Scholars for a New Deal in Higher Education, and they're putting together a bunch of you know, the program that they're running behind is just more the best way, as Dana said earlier, to fix the problem around debt is to fund our universities. So they're, I think following, seeing what they're up to, there's a bunch of webinars and workshops that they run, including, I think later this summer, there's going to be a higher ed labor forum that they're going to host to try to make these issues around funding for good jobs at universities, for affordable universities, how to cohere a unified higher ed labor voice around that. So stay tuned for details on that too.
Fantastic. I mean, I see like, you know, t-shirts and bumper stickers with how to solve the crisis in higher education. Fund them. Yeah. I mean, it seems like, you know, it's like that Occam's razor thing, right? What's the shortest distance? Like, this is the easiest solution,
right? Exactly.
Well, listen, you know, I really appreciate you, Dana and Eleni, coming on today and kind of sharing a little bit what's happening around the debt organizing. I absolutely love the work that you all have been doing. And I'll have links to some of the articles that came out from The Nation. One that's kind of really announcing the day of the kind of debt reveal. I've got another article in there that Eleni, you had written, it was a little bit longer ago. Say it's not just students drowning in debt, like colleges are too. And a link to every place that you can go to help, you know, join in and get educated and organize and connect with other folks over the summer so that we can really take this on. Because, you know, obviously I'm an interested party here. I'm a faculty member at Kutztown University. I'm a union member who has been, you know, active in my faculty union for as long as I've been at the university. And it does feel devastating at times to see the thing that I have loved so much and so many people that I know have committed their lives to, is we're working with students and passing on and kind of and educating kind of the next generation of citizens, to see this under attack, and potentially losing it. You know, at the very moment that we're having to defend our democratic institutions, we're having to defend public higher education, which is integrally connected to that. So Dana and Eleni, thank you so much for joining me today on kind of Out to Coop Live.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Solidarity.
Here you go. All right, everybody. Yeah. We're going to wrap up today's show, and I want to remind you that I'm going to be out of town again through next week. So just, you know, check our podcast feed, because we're probably going to have some replays that are for our Friday show. It looks like Cyril Michaleko may be taking over the Wednesday show and going solo. So you'll have kind of brand new content there. And then when we get back, we're going to have a whole lineup. So all I'm going to say is July is going to be hot. So make sure that you're tuning in to Out to Coop Live. Make sure you're checking our feeds. And, you know, look, if you do anything this summer, it's like, you know, build out your communities. If, as we see COVID, you know, the restrictions beginning to open up, it's a perfect opportunity to kind of reconnect with people and thinking about, you know, how do we strategize kind of in person while regenerating for the fights ahead. So anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I want to remind you can help support this show by going to patreon.com/rcpress, where you become a patron for as little as $5 a month. We'll see you on the flip side, everybody. We're out. See ya!